This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 170. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Todd Brennan Fahey titled The Acid Messiah, Captain Al Hubbard, and is being released on Friday, August 9, 2013. This interview with Todd was recorded on Wednesday, August 7. In this interview, we discuss the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, and it's not Timothy Leary. In fact, today we'll be discussing Captain Trips, Al Hubbard, the man who supplied all of North America, including the CIA, FBI, U.S. Army, and even Canada, with Sandoz LSD. Every dose of Sandoz LSD-25 that came from the Grateful Dead, or Tim Leary, or anyone else, including those involved with MKUltra, got their LSD from this man. Al Hubbard even personally dosed Aldous Huxley. Todd Brennan Fahey is a PhD candidate in English at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. He holds a master's in professional writing from the University of Southern California, received his bachelor's of science cum laude in justice studies from Arizona State University, and studied in 1985 at the University of London, Union College. He began graduate coursework at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State before his acceptance into the prestigious professional writing program at USC. Fahey has served as an aide to Central Intelligence Agency agent Theodore L. Ted Humes, Division of Slavic Languages, and to the late Defense Intelligence Agency DIA Chief Lieutenant General Daniel O. Graham, to former Arizona Governor Evan Meacham, and former Congressman John Conlon, and others. And both of those were Republicans from Arizona. And for this episode, I'm going to include quite a number of links, so you'll want to definitely check out the Gnostic Media website for this podcast and follow up on the links, and there'll also be documents, etc., linked for this episode, about 17 or 18 documents there. And donations, this episode is brought to you by David, Paul, who donated twice, Oof, Sam, Simon, John, Scott, Tad, Joseph, Max, Oscar, Lewis, Stephen, Thomas, Aaron, and Evo. And next episode is going to be with John Rush, who is back for his fifth time to discuss his new book that I'm also in, Entheogens and the Development of Culture. And you won't want to miss that one. Would you believe that there is a history of using psychedelics for social control? And we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, so your donations and website purchases are greatly appreciated. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And let's see, of course, by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering books or bookmarks or DVDs or She Who Remembers archives or T-shirts or getting a membership to download the shows that are older than 3 months, you help to continue this unprogramming. And also up there are the first 4 years of the Gnostic Media podcast, etc. Anyway, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can go to the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website, or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Here is my interview with Todd Brennan Fahey. Enjoy.
Thank you, Jan, for the invitation.
Yeah, Todd, welcome to the Gnostic Media podcast, and I'm glad to have you here. And this is a really important topic. You know, what's funny is it's come up recently. Somebody was asking me if we've covered this subject that we're going to be covering today, which is the Acid Messiah, who was Captain Al Hubbard. So, Todd, and why don't you start off a little bit with your educational background, that sort of thing.
All right. I was accepted into the Criminal Justice Department at University of California, Santa Barbara, in 1983. I stayed in Santa Barbara until December of 1984. Had a fairly emotional breakup with a girlfriend and decided to transfer to Arizona State. And so I attended and lived in Tempe, Arizona from between 1985 to my graduation in 1988. Graduated in the College of Criminal Justice from Arizona State University. I had toyed around with either becoming an attorney or becoming involved in the intelligence apparatus of the United States government. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, but decided that neither one fit my personality and demeanor.
Yeah, and you had actually worked for Ted or Theodore Humes, correct? At who is a CIA agent for a while.
Yeah, I did. There are so many digressions to these stories that it's going to be hard to piece together. So let me get into my experience in Arizona. Actually, let me back up to Santa Barbara. I'm probably the only guy you're ever going to meet who read the book None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen under the influence of magic mushrooms. And then subsequently became a member of the John Birch Society whilst still active in psychedelics. I'm one of the strangest paradoxes you've ever met in your life. And I know this about myself. So when I was a student in Santa Barbara, a friend of mine turned me on to None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And I was lit. I was high on mushrooms when I read it. And it just changed my world. It changed the way that I looked at things. The fact that there are creatures like the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission who are literally running the United States government. I hadn't known that before. This was new information. And the profundity of being on mushrooms while reading None Dare Call It Conspiracy just blew my mind. I didn't give up psychedelics, but I did delve deeply into the John Birch Society and to conspiracy theory. And so that's what led to this this perfect storm that I've been living my entire adult life, basically. So I transferred to Arizona State University in January of 1985 and was a member of the John Birch Society and decided to form the first ever registered university chapter of the John Birch Society, ever officially at a university, at Arizona State University. Why did I do this? I still don't know. But I had to contact the headquarters, which were then in Belmont, Massachusetts. I had to gain permission from John F. McManus, or Jack McManus, who is still the president of the John Birch Society. They heard my speech, they heard my spiel, they saw how interested I was in exposing this dirty apparatus of the CFR and Trilateral Commission and doing it on a university campus. The John Birch Society administration was impressed and they gave me the go-ahead to do so. I had to gain all sorts of paperwork and approval through Arizona State University to actually have this thing, this chapter of the JBS registered at the university. There were a lot of eyebrows, a lot of complaints raised, but to my surprise, the administration of ASU approved it. And so for the next 3 years, I was the president of the Students for the John Birch Society at Arizona State University at Arizona State University. Continue
so,
on.
So what do you think of that today?
Oh, I'm still I'm still somewhat affiliated with the JBS. I have deep admiration with what they do. In my opinion, there's very few other large organizations that have so completely and significantly exposed the machinations of the Trilateral Commission and the CFR and the Bilderberg Group, as has the John Birch Society. I no longer pay dues. I'm no longer a registered member, but I have lots of friends within the JBS. I still consider myself that sort of, I guess you would call it, right-winger. I have more libertarian instincts than I do classic right-wing instincts, but again, that's a paradox that I am, kind of a bridge between the Ron Paul community and the Republican Party.
What do you... Well, let's go back for a minute to your working as an aide to the CIA agent, Ted Humes. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I have to talk about that. All right. At the time, I was leading the chapter of the John Birch Society at ASU. I was also the director of public relations for the Young Republican League in the state of Arizona. And I had set out as a goal, grandiosely, but very purposefully, very sincerely, to disrupt and ultimately take over the Young Republican League in Arizona and pack it full of John Birch style, you can use the word conspiracy theorists, but there's no theory about it. This stuff that they have, and you have, and other bright minds have exposed is not theory, it's actual fact.
Sure.
So I wanted to take over the Young Republican League, and in the process, I became acquainted with some very, very right-wing Republicans, one of which was a former congressman named John Conlon, who held office for two terms in Congress and then ran for Senate and lost. He had been out of action for 10 years, decided in 1986, I believe, to come back and to try to regain his congressional seat. He was ultimately unsuccessful, but I became one of his very, very top chief aides, and I was 23 years old. He gave me the keys to his headquarters. He gave me the combination of the security lock. He and his campaign manager named Edith Richardson just trusted everything that I did, and they knew what a wild card I was, and they liked it, actually. So John Conlon lost the congressional election to now Senator John Kyle, and Conlon retired from all political aspirations thereafter. His chief of staff, Edith Richardson, was then picked up by Governor Evan Meekum. Governor Evan Meekum won a three-way race due to an independent businessman coming in and running against the Democrat, which split the Democrat vote. And so Evan Meekum had run for governor of Arizona, I believe, five different times. He had lost every single time. He was considered a wacko. He is, or was, he passed away about 4 years ago, I believe, a member of the John Birch Society. I knew him. I got along well with him. Edith Richardson, who was the chief of staff of John Conlon's unsuccessful congressional comeback bid, became the top advisor to Evan Meekum. When Evan Meekum was elected by a toenail in terms of the popular vote, a phone call from Edith Richardson. She invited me down to her office, which was now on the top floor of the governor's building. And she smiled, and she opened her portfolio of jobs open, and she said, "What do you want to do?" She offered me anything that I wanted, absolutely anything that I wanted to do, I could do. There was only one thing that I wanted to do, and I wanted to work for a man named Ted Humes. Who was Ted Humes? Ted Humes grew up in Pennsylvania. He ran for Congress twice in the 1970s. He lost both times to the same man, John Murtaugh, Democrat. And Ted Humes retired from political aspirations also. I had heard him speaking at Republican functions in Arizona several times. The man had a mind sharper than anything that I've ever experienced before in my life, a great sense of satire. He was extremely right-wing in the mode and the model of the JBS, saw conspiracies everywhere, and I found out why. Drinking a cup of coffee now.
And why were they everywhere?
He admitted that he had been a CIA agent and stationed in Japan in 1950, and his station partner was none other than William F. Buckley, the founder and the president of National Review magazine. Ted Humes was station partner in Japan for the CIA with William F. Buckley. So, of course, he was going to see conspiracies everywhere. He had been involved in conspiracies everywhere. But the guy was funny. He was wonderful. He was wise. He was very much a father figure to me. And he had joined Evan Meekum's administration in a really, really low-rent department called the Residential Utility Consumer Organization. I won't bother even going into what it was. Ted Humes' purpose for being hired to the Evan Meekum administration was basically to root out all of the previous members of Bruce Babbitt's governorship. Bruce Babbitt had been a two-time governor prior to Evan Meekum's election, and Ted Humes was hired as a spy, which is what he was and what he did well, to Evan Meekum's governorship. Ted Humes knew of me. He knew of me through the Young Republican League, and so he hired me immediately, and I was his right-hand man. And so essentially, he and I were both spies within the Meekum administration in the governorship in Arizona.
Well, there's an interesting background for you. We don't get too many like that, if any, on this show. So, did I have it right? Were you talking about the Hument effort, or did I have that written down wrong?
No, you have it right.
Okay, what is that?
Hument stands for human intelligence, and it's a term used by CIA, and one day I was talking to Ted in his office, and we had done a few things. We had succeeded in firing quite a few people who had been members of the Bruce Babbitt governorship. Done some background investigation, done some on-site investigation in terms of performance and leaking information out of Evan Meekum's newly acquired governorship. And Ted Humes one day looked at me just straight in the eyes and said, and I quote, This is something that came exactly from his mouth. He said to me, "You are the most natural human agent I have ever seen." And I was just really, really blown away. So I wrote Human Effort, and I went into the discovery process of Al Hubbard, Alfred Matthew Hubbard, who we're talking about right now. Actually, we've been talking way more about me than we should.
Yeah, well, why don't we say who is, you know, tell us who is Al Hubbard before we go into his background.
Al Hubbard was the sole licensed importer of LSD in North America, specifically in Canada. He was an American citizen. He was forced to relocate to Canada because he was facing congressional indictment for activities that he performed during the end of World War II, chiefly which was to load boats and ship equipment from the West Coast, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle, loaded with uranium materials to England. And this violated certain federal protocols, and people in Congress found out, and he was under federal indictment. And with the help of then OSS apparatus, senior apparatus, he was helped to be given a Canadian citizenship and relocated to Canada and became a Canadian citizen.
How did you begin investigating him?
Like a whole lot of other people, I had read two books, and there are two books that you've read and that thousands of other people have read. The first being Acid Dreams by Martin Lee and Bruce Schlein. And the other was Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream by Jay Stevens. And I was living in Santa Barbara. I was back in Santa Barbara at that time after graduating from Arizona State University. This was 1989. I was back in Santa Barbara. I had been accepted into the master's degree in professional writing at University of Southern California. I had a full-time job in Santa Barbara, and so I commuted two nights a week to USC to attend classes in my first semester. I was taking a lot of LSD at the time, a lot, and a friend of mine turned me on to both of these books, Acid Dreams and Storming Heaven. I had never heard of them. They had just recently been published. I believe both were published in 1987, so this was only a year and a half or 2 years maximum after they were first published. But I had not heard of these books before. As an aficionado of LSD, I read both of these books, was just blown away at the subject matter and the intensity of the research that both Martin Lee and Jay Stevens had conducted in their respective books. But one character, one human being, one person out of all of the litany of people who are featured in both of these books jumped out at me, and that was a man named Al Hubbard. And he just jumped right out at me. And it was almost as if something supernatural was telling me, you need to know more about this man. Not enough has been done. There are fragments, there are stories, there are brief chapters in both books on Al Hubbard. But there was a lot more to know, and I was the guy to do it. And that was my obsession for the next 2 years.
So Al Hubbard was known as the Acid Messiah and the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. Why is that?
He was known as three things: the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, the original Captain Trips, and the Acid Messiah. Those are three titles that were conveyed upon him. Why was that? He imported all, and I am talking about all, of the LSD from Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland to distribute to psychiatrists in the United States of America. So when you read about Carrot and Jack Nicholson and Stanley Kubrick and novelist Anis
Nin, we'll get to them in a bit, though.
Sure. All of that acid that psychiatrists dispensed to these very, very famous people came from Al Hubbard. Al Hubbard was the dealer. He was the distributor of the entirety, and I'm talking about 100% of the LSD that came into the Hollywood community in the very early days before the hippies, before acid was ever even talked about.
Sure.
Came from Al Hubbard.
So you claim in your published interview with Are You Serious that it appears that someone wanted Hubbard's story told. Why do you think that is so?
All right. I contacted Al Hubbard's widow, Rita Hubbard, who was living then in Upland, California.
Oh, that's about 20 minutes from me.
Yeah. I do believe she's not alive today. This was 20 years ago. She must have been in her 70s now. I doubt she's still alive today. I had her phone number, and I'm going to have to backtrack a little bit later into how I got her phone number, but I had her phone number. I called her. I was dead determined to do as much research on Al Hubbard as I possibly could, as any human could. And so the natural connection was, well, contact his widow, contact his ex-wife. So I did. She spoke about three sentences to me on the phone. She did take my call, and she said, "I do not speak of my late husband. All questions regarding Al Hubbard are given to a man who I trust. I will give him your phone number. If he decides that it's in his best interest, in Al Hubbard's best interest, to talk to you, you'll get a phone call back. If you don't get a phone call back, don't call me again." 3 days later, I received a phone call at a law firm at which I was working as a legal editor in Los Angeles, California, from a man named Bill Darling. If you go to the book, I believe it's Acid Dreams, and if you see the picture, the photograph of Al Hubbard in the chapter of the original Captain Trips, the notation underneath says, "Courtesy, Bill Darling." So this was the man who was calling me on the phone. And I was thinking to myself, holy shit, I'm talking to the guy who either took the photograph or had rights to the photograph of Al Hubbard, of which there were very few. He is a very mysterious man. And this guy was calling me back at my law office. And he put me through a real litany of questions. And why do you want to know this guy? What is your background? What are you doing? I told him that I was writing a master's thesis at USC and that it involved Al Hubbard. And that was partially true. I was writing my novel, Wisdom's Maw, which does feature Al Hubbard. So I wasn't telling a lie. And he was satisfied with my answers, and he opened up the first doors to Al Hubbard to me, this man named Bill Darling. I also doubt he is still alive. He was very overweight, possessed with high blood pressure. He must have been in his late 60s, this being in 1990, and I doubt he is still alive either. I might be wrong. he invited me to his house in Thousand Oaks, California. And Dion, you can ask the next question.
All right, so let's see here. Where was I? What evidence do you have that Al Hubbard was CIA? And I should mention here that many others have well evidence that he was, but what evidence do you have?
Bill Darling was the single executor of Al Hubbard's estate. Bill Darling had everything that Al Hubbard had accumulated. All records, all correspondence, all photographs. He was the sole repository of everything that Al Hubbard had.
Are there any archives at a university or anything anywhere of Al Hubbard's these papers?
There won't be. Bill Darling made it clear that the only person Al Hubbard trusted was him. And so when I walked into Bill Darling's house in 1990 in Thousand Oaks, California, he led me to a room. And the room wasn't massive, but it was just absolutely stacked with files and boxes and tape recordings, video, audio, just every media possible at that time, all of which was related to Al Hubbard. He owned everything that Al Hubbard had done, communicated with, and had possessed and acquired. And I know that Bill Darling did not ever and wouldn't ever turn this stuff over to a university library. He made that clear to me.
What do you think of Hank Alberelli's work on this topic?
What I've read of Hank Alberelli's work is that Hank had performed the Freedom of Information Act request of the CIA on MKUltra, and that Al Hubbard's name indeed did come out through CIA records. A lot of it was very, very heavily redacted, which means that black ink is scrolled across the lines.
So sure, always.
But Al Hubbard's name did come up. It is known also, not only through Hank Alberelli's FOIA request, and I realize that you have issues with Hank Alberelli, as do I, but also through the FOIA request from a man named Russ Kick of the FBI. Russ Kick was the owner and founder of thememoryhole.org. He's still alive. He has largely disappeared. I don't know why. And thememoryhole.org was taken offline in 2005, and I don't know why that either. But Russ Kick did a FOIA request of the FBI on its involvement in LSD. And again, Al Hubbard's name came up many, many times. And through the cross-section of Hank Alberelli's FOIA request and that of Russ Kick of the FBI, it is known now that George Hunter White, who ran Operation Midnight Climax...
Well, sure. He's the one that had Frank Olson murdered, isn't he, George Hunter White? He had Pierre Lafitte murder him.
I believe you're correct about that.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, not at all. Operation Midnight Climax was largely a blackmail operation in which high-level businessmen and diplomats and maybe even government officials sat in bars around both the San Francisco and the Greenwich Village area, had their drinks spiked with LSD, were approached by beautiful prostitutes, and were taken back to a number of different safe houses operated by the FBI, ostensibly. I'm sure the CIA also had involvement in it, but it was an FBI operation, Midnight Climax was. It was not CIA. The Johns, the unwitting dupes, were brought back. Their sexual encounters with the prostitutes were tape recorded and video recorded behind two-way mirrors, which the FBI set up, and which George Hunter White operated and found to be hilarious and a great kick. He was a sadist. He was a sick man. All, and I'm talking all, of the LSD that George Hunter White used was provided to him by, guess who?
Al Hubbard.
By Al Hubbard. All of it. Every bit of LSD that George Hunter White procured for the FBI came through Al Hubbard.
FBI and CIA under MKUltra, correct?
This is correct, both.
Right. All right, so about Hubbard's background.
There are no known birth certificates for Al Hubbard. People have searched far and wide. Nobody has ever come up. I have searched far and wide. People who have also researched Hubbard, no birth certificates are evident. Apparently, he was born in Kentucky in 1901. He died in 1982, so he was 81 years old when he died. He was born to a dirt poor family in Kentucky. His father was a moonshiner, a maker of illegal whiskey. His father apparently was shot by feds and killed when Al Hubbard was 13 years old. And Al Hubbard was the eldest child of the Hubbard family and basically had to go to work and did whatever he could, chopped wood, did odd jobs, this being in the Depression. No, this being earlier than the Depression. Sorry about that, my mistake. But being in an Appalachian family in Kentucky, did whatever he could because his father had been killed. And I doubt Al Hubbard had more than an eighth grade education, if that. I'm guessing that he might have gone through sixth grade, perhaps eighth grade. That's all the formal education that he had. And the man was a genius. He was a stone, God-blessed genius. How do these things happen? We're not smart enough to know.
Well, usually they stay out of compulsory education.
That might have been the trick for Hubbard. Because he certainly didn't have compulsory education. He probably had the back end of his mom's whip to educate him.
Well, sure. I mean, if you look at the 1800s, how many 12 and 14-year-olds ran major corporations, et cetera, it's just absolutely stunning.
Of course. Yeah. Andrew Carnegie is not somebody really to be praised on a lot of fronts. But the guy was the equivalent of a millionaire by the time he was maybe 18 years old. So.
Sure. Well, let's go in. You had filed FOIA requests on Hubbard, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
And what was the CIA, and I suppose you probably filed CIA and FBI, correct?
I only did CIA. Never
okay.
FBI.
And what was the CIA's response?
One single line. We have no records whatsoever on one, and it was in quotations, on one Alfred M. Hubbard. Nothing.
They didn't. They said they just absolutely had nothing. They didn't say responsive records like they do if they're hiding something.
They had nothing whatsoever, and so
nice.
We have no records on one Al Hubbard.
It's always nice when they just give you a straight answer like that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was a lie. I mean, the CIA has a policy of not acknowledging nor disclaiming its own agents, so I don't take that for anything at all.
Sure.
They just denied the fact that he existed.
Well, I mean, they could have been destroyed in the 1973 document destruction and all of that.
Yeah, Richard Helms.
Sure, because, I mean, if Al Hubbard was really the key guy behind all of that, they probably would have wanted to make sure they pulled everything they could and burned it.
Obviously. There's also one interesting thing about Hubbard which leads me to believe that, yes, definitely he was CIA. And I got this from Myron Stolaroff. Myron Stolaroff was a high-level official in the Ampex Corporation, which was a tape recording. Everybody my age remembers Ampex tapes. If you buy a cassette recorder, you were going to use probably Ampex tapes. They were the magnetic tapes that existed at that time. Myron Stolaroff quit Ampex Corporation. He was turned on to LSD by Al Hubbard, and he became one of Hubbard's best friends.
Was he related with Willis Herrmann also?
Yeah, all three of those men had great close connections.
And, of course, the one that I just mentioned, Willis Herrmann, he was another huge and very little discussed figure in, behind MKUltra. He and Al Hubbard are probably the two least talked about in the entire story.
Yeah, Willis Herrmann ran SRI, which is the acronym for the Stanford Research Institute. And SRI disassociated legally from Stanford University in 1970, and since 1975 has been titled SRI International. It's no longer officially part of Stanford University. There were a lot of political disagreements on the direction that Stanford Research Institute was taking in terms of gaining defense contracts. The provost and president of Stanford University didn't want any part of it, and they had to divorce. So,
the MKUltra is centered around SRI, and SRI tie all these characters tie directly into Esalen and everything. So I can imagine that the university would want a quick and short divorce.
Sure, sure.
And cheap.
Willis Herrmann was the chairman of SRI, and SRI was running an operation called the Alternative Futures Project. Very little is known about it. There are no significant published records of it. Again, it was suppressed intentionally. We don't really know what the goals of the Alternative Futures Project are. What we do know is that Willis Herrmann, as chairman of SRI, and as the organizer of the Alternative Futures Project, which sought to attract very high-level CEOs and military figures and the mucky-muck of the United States of America to its ranks, Willis Herrmann employed Al Hubbard to run the LSD sessions for SRI under its Alternative Futures Project. We have this. I have this on tape. I interviewed Willis Herrmann. I have it on tape, and we have it in multi-documentation. So Al Hubbard was right square in the middle of so many things, and yet he's one of the most unacknowledged men of historical importance in the United States of America.
Yeah, well, secretly manipulating the masses isn't something that they tend to advertise so much. I mean, you know, look at Aldous Huxley. He and his whole family have been behind this stuff for 200 years, and, you know, he dumbs it down. But, you know, speaking of Aldous Huxley, you state, among Hubbard's heavyweight cheerleaders was Aldous Huxley, author of the sardonic novel Brave New World. Huxley had been turned on to mescaline by Osman in 1953, an experience that spawned the seminal psychedelic book Doors of Perception. Huxley became an unabashed sponsor for the chemicals then known as psychotomimetic, literally madness mimicking. What do you have to say about this?
Well, I'll go one step further. It was Humphrey Osman who gave Aldous Huxley his first dose of synthetic mescaline, which is the peyote cactus, which has psychedelic properties, used for thousands of years by various Native American, Indian, South American Indian tribes.
And Humphrey Osman was MKUltra, wasn't he?
I'm going to suspect, yes. I do not have proof, but let me get back to to what I was speaking about sure. just a second ago. Humphrey Osmond turned Aldous Huxley onto mescaline, but guess who turned on Aldous Huxley to LSD for the very first time?
And that would be who? Al Hubbard?
Al Hubbard.
And, you know, in... well, let's go to Laura Huxley, and you had interviewed her. Talk about her comments on Alan. She says here, quoting you, I think, Laura Huxley met Captain Hubbard for the first time at her husband's Hollywood Hills home in the early 1960s. He showed up for lunch one afternoon, and he brought with him a portable tank filled with gas of some kind. He offered some to us, she recalls, but we didn't care for any, so he put it down and we all had lunch. He went into the bathroom with the tank after lunch and breathed into it for about 10 seconds. It must have been very concentrated because he came out revitalized and very jubilant, talking about a vision he had seen of the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, this is what Laura Archera Huxley told me physically in person at the home that she and Aldous Huxley had shared during their marriage. Aldous Huxley died on the same day as John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. I believe it was November 11th. I might be wrong on the exact date, but it was
sure.
November 63.
Aldous and Huxley and of course, interestingly, Wasson has been tied directly into the JFK assassination, who was friends with Aldous Huxley at the Century Club.
Yeah. We could probably do a review just on the JFK assassination, but I showed up after having called Laura Archera Huxley maybe three times over a period of 2 weeks. She seemed a bit resistant to an interview, although she didn't say no. She made it clear that she wanted to be interviewed at her home, and it was a beautiful, although very decrepit, home above Mulholland Drive in the Hollywood Hills. Their back balcony, you could literally nearly reach out and touch that famous Hollywood sign. It was right up there. Beautiful hills. One day she called me and said, okay, today I am available. Come up to my house. Here's my address. And I will speak to you about this man who you want to speak about, being Al Hubbard. So I drove up to her home. I had to wait about 45 minutes. She wasn't on time. So what? She was more famous than I was, but I had to wait for 45 minutes. I made the mistake of walking onto her front lawn instead of staying in my car on the street. And I wasn't doing anything. I didn't go in the back. I didn't do anything at all. But I was just walking around, gazing at the home in the front yard in fairly public view. And she was very irritated when she drove up. I would appreciate if you stay off my property until you're invited. She was a very, very edgy, very strange woman. I did not have a great experience with her. She is the only person who I interviewed amongst maybe 11 or 12 people in Al Hubbard's inner circle who denied me the opportunity to tape record the conversation. I pulled out the tape recorder. I put it on it was a little small dictaphone. Put it on the coffee table. I asked her, may I turn on this tape for veracity so that you can know that I am writing everything that we've actually talked about with no mistakes? She said, no, I would prefer you not. Notes are sufficient. So I had to turn off the tape. She was a very prickly woman. Didn't give me a whole lot of time. And honestly, she did not seem to know Al Hubbard all that much, except for his visits to the Huxley home when she and Aldous Huxley were both together. Obviously, Al Hubbard and Aldous Huxley spent hundreds and hundreds of hours together, but not in her presence. So she didn't really know much
right.
about it.
Right.
She saw him go into the bathroom with his notable tank full of what was called carbogen, which is a mixture of, I don't know, carbon dioxide or something and oxygen, and would get Al Hubbard high. And he was very noted for carting this portable tank around and huffing into it. And it kind of reminds me of that David Lynch scene in Blue Velvet where Dennis Hopper's huffing into this portable tank and starts yelling, "Mommy, Mommy!" And it's just very, very bizarre. Al Hubbard was a strange, strange character.
You and I had discussed on Monday, I think it was, the possibility of Huxley being behind much of MKUltra. And in light of our conversation, you know, and I had been breaking down all of my research on that. But in light of that conversation, what do you think about that idea now?
Well, what do I think about it? When I wrote Wisdom's Maw, when I wrote the novel that came after the article that I published in, or that I got published in High Times magazine called The Original Captain Trips on Al Hubbard, I had a ton of research left. I had a ton of interviews on tape. I was limited in space to that which a magazine could provide, and I was happy with a 5-page publication in High Times, very, very happy. But I had a whole lot of information left. And I went back and I listened to the tapes and I listened to people talking, and Aldous Huxley's name came up every time I talked about Al Hubbard to Humphrey Osmond, to Willis Harmon, to Dr. Oscar Janiger, who was the psychiatrist who turned on Jack Nicholson and Cary Grant, whose LSD came from Al Hubbard. And so it's pretty obvious that Aldous Huxley was neck deep into the CIA's research. I don't know exactly what title he held. I don't know how he was involved, but he certainly wasn't an innocent. So, I mean, you've brought up that he was one of the high-level operatives of MKUltra, and I don't discount that. I don't discount it.
Yeah, you know, my own research shows that he, you know, was probably running the core operations, and in fact, I think it's a page 52 or 56 in his book Moksha, he's talking about this, it's October 1954 or something, long before anybody knew anything about MKUltra or any of this, and he's talking about mescaline research that he's doing and in Egypt, pretending that he's a doctor there, and he's actually there, you know, telling people what studies need to be done. And it's like, well, how would you even have this information unless you're actually directing, you know, the studies that need to be done, et cetera? So, you know, what I find throughout Huxley's work is that he's actually directing much of this stuff.
Again, I'm not going to argue with you. I've got no factual documentation that is stamped on CIA stationery talking about Aldous Huxley. I don't have any kind of information like that.
Sure. It's just, you know, the interesting issue, like you noticed as well, is that all roads, like Al Hubbard, all roads also seem to link to Aldous Huxley, both of the AHs. Al Hubbard and Aldous Huxley, right?
Well, sure. You're absolutely correct. And I think, again, it's important to restate that the first time Aldous Huxley ever tried LSD, it was given to him by
Al Hubbard. Right.
So,
I mean, how much closer can you get? And in fact, there's the photograph of him and Al Hubbard together. And who's the third person there?
The third person's Gerald Hurd.
Gerald Hurd, interesting.
Philosopher.
And one of the very few photos of Aldous Huxley or of Al Hubbard available happens to have Al Huxley, who I think was one of the key people behind MKUltra, and of course his brother ran the British Eugenics Society.
Yeah. I'll tell you where that photograph came from.
All right.
That photograph came from Bill Darling during my visit to Bill Darling's house in Thousand Oaks, California in 1990. Bill Darling made the mistake of turning around at an inopportune time. And I hope he's no longer alive. I really do. And there were some documents and some negatives laying on the desk, which were no longer laying on the desk after I left his house. So from unexposed negatives, that was the photo that you see on my website, the original Captain Trips. That photo came out of the house of a man named Bill Darling, who I suspect is or was, if he's still alive, a CIA agent.
All right, so let's get back into, let's get back into Al Hubbard's background. Wasn't he a rum runner, and why would the CIA want a rum runner working for them in the distribution of LSD and other drugs?
All right, going directly to the rum running thing, Hubbard, again, was a genius. He was a God-gifted, God-touched genius with no formal education. He was an expert in communications, and he, during Prohibition, I believe around 1920, 1921, created a ship-to-shore equivalent to a CB, Citizens Band Radio. Hubbard created this thing, and he hid it in the back of his taxi cab, and he was a glorified taxi driver, I believe undercover. I don't think that was his real job, but he posed as a taxi driver with this communications equipment hidden in the trunk of his taxi, and the purpose of this communications equipment was to speak to ships offshore on the Pacific coast, which were running alcohol up and down the coast, Mexico to Seattle, during Prohibition. And Al Hubbard was the chief architect of this, and he was the designer and builder of this communications equipment. And he was helping the mafia, he was helping the mob run alcohol during Prohibition up and down the Pacific coast. He got busted in Los Angeles, California, with a huge load of alcohol, which was then illegal during Prohibition, that came from Mexico. And Al Hubbard ended up doing 18 months in a federal penitentiary, I believe in Walla Walla, Washington. 18 months, a year and a half, for violating the Prohibition laws.
And then he was pardoned of any wrongdoing by Harry Truman, correct?
By Harry Truman, and I'm the one who did that FOIA request of the State Department, which proved, in fact, that the pardon number and the fact that Hubbard was one of the ones who was pardoned. I was the one who did the FOIA request of that.
Did we already talk about what sparked Hubbard's interest in LSD?
No, we haven't yet. Okay, I'll go directly question.
Please.
apparently in 1951, Hubbard was reading a scientific journal called the Hibberd Journal, H-I-B-B-E-R-D. And one of the articles in the Hibberd Journal, and again, it was an eccentric, esoteric scientific journal. I have no idea why he was reading this. He was a nut. He was interested in everything. He came across an article on the behavior of rats given LSD. And previously, many years earlier, Al Hubbard had walked into a clearing near Spokane, Washington. And he says, and this is what Myron Stoleroff and Humphrey Osmond both told me independently, Al Hubbard claimed that two angels, two female angels, appeared to him in a clearing. They were not human beings, they were angels. And they both spoke to Hubbard, and they told him that something of great importance will be happening in the future, and you can be part of it if you would like to be. All right, sounds strange, yeah, obviously. When Hubbard opened up the pages of this Hibbard journal and saw this article on rats being given LSD, he was possessed, absolutely, that this is what those two female angels were talking about. And that's why he became interested in acid. And then he contacted almost immediately the creator of LSD, or the chemical plant which created and dispensed LSD, Sandoz Laboratories in Basel, Switzerland. And he made an exerted effort to procure Sandoz's acid supply.
And Hubbard was employed by the OSS, the Canadian Special Forces, the U.S. Justice Department, the BATF, apparently the CIA. Are we missing any here?
I really can't think of any we'd be missing. We've touched the top five.
And you say that he, you know, and earlier we started to go into this, but you say that he dosed Bill Wilson, who founded AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous.
His first LSD experiment by Al Hubbard, correct.
And then we already just talked about Aldous Huxley, and we also have Jack Nicholson and Stanley Kubrick, etc. How ironic.
Yeah. Hubbard did not give the LSD directly to Nicholson or Cary Grant or to Stanley Kubrick. That was LSD that Al Hubbard had given the psychiatrists in Los Angeles, California, chiefly Oscar Janiger. And they came to his clinic, and then they were administered the LSD. The LSD came to Oscar Janiger from Al Hubbard.
And you state that Stolaroff learned of Hubbard through philosopher Gerald Hurd, which I guess we just talked about that one, who was a friend and spiritual mentor to Aldous Huxley.
Correct.
All right. So did Hubbard go from, or how did Hubbard go from the head of a uranium mining company to being the messiah for LSD?
This is a blank spot. This is something that nobody has ever been able to pin down.
Nobody's cracked that egg yet, huh?
Nobody's cracked that egg.
Come on, Todd. You've got all of this other stuff here.
There's a lot that I want to do.
You know, what's funny is when I was investigating Aldous Huxley's background, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was emailing with you, and just about every, you know, or a good portion of the things that I was coming up with on the ties between Huxley and Al Hubbard, etc., were coming from you. And then, you know, months later, you would contact me, and I realized, oh, we're, you know, small little circle here.
Yeah, can you allow me maybe a couple of minutes to get back to how I learned about Al Hubbard's inner circle?
Sure, please do.
All right. Being a master's degree candidate in professional writing, I was taking classes at USC in Los Angeles. One of my professors was a man named Paul Gillette. Paul Gillette wrote the novel Play Misty for me, which was optioned by Clint Eastwood and was Clint Eastwood's first movie that he directed. Paul Gillette wrote Play Misty for me, and during the 1970s had a television show on CBS, and it was a talk show, and he would invite famous and strange people, and no different really from the Merv Griffin show or something like that, but for maybe a two-year period, Paul Gillette had a TV show on CBS. Paul Gillette and I were great friends. He was my professor, but he was also my friend. We were drinking pals. He knew a lot about me, and he knew that I was a an aficionado of psychedelic drugs, and that was no secret to anybody. But Paul Gillette actually sympathized with it. He didn't empathize with it. He was a drinker. He was not a druggie. And he was looking over pages of my then nascent, unfinished novel, Wisdom's Maw. And he said, huh, all right. He said, you are really interested in this stuff, aren't you? You're not just playing around with acid. And I said, of course. He said, okay. One of my guests on my CBS television show was none other than Humphrey Osmond. Humphrey Osmond was the British doctor, psychiatrist who had emigrated to Canada and was experimenting with mescaline and later with LSD, which was provided by Al Hubbard. And Humphrey Osmond was then, in 1990, the head of a psychiatric hospital called Bryce Hospital in Alabama, I believe Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And Paul Gillette gave me his phone number. So being the research fanatic and psychedelic fanatic that I was, I called Humphrey Osmond, and he took my phone call. And then he canceled his whole day's roster of patients. And he stayed on the phone with me for 4.5 hours talking about Al Hubbard. He was absolutely thrilled to talk about him. So Humphrey Osmond's on the phone with me. I'm asking what I guess were considered really, really good, intelligent questions. And by the end of our phone call, Dr. Humphrey Osmond said, you know, you are sincere. You have a sincere interest in this man. And frankly, I think that more people need to know about Al Hubbard. Not enough has been written of him. So here you go. And he gave me his entire Rolodex of everybody who was still alive who was associated with Al Hubbard.
That's pretty incredible. And of course, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, Humphrey Osmond was MK Ultra.
And he wasn't shy. The man wasn't shy at all. And he was the one who actually told me, and this was the first time that it's ever been told to anybody, as far as I can trace. I'm the first person who has written this, and I got the information directly from a phone call to Humphrey Osmond that Al Hubbard had actually planned to assassinate by gun Timothy Leary.
Yeah, well, that was one of my next questions here. So what's the story behind him wanting to assassinate Tim Leary? I mean, they're all CIA agents. Tim Leary had entrance exams for the CIA.
Yes, he did. The Leary personality test.
And they are still used today, as far as I know.
Yes, they are.
And I'm guilty as well. I smoked a joint with Leary in his backyard in 1994. So there you go, folks.
You're hearing me clapping right now?
I heard it sounded like a one-legged something flapping.
Maybe it's a mono microphone going on.
Yeah. Mono microphone. There you go. So what's the story behind Hubbard wanting to assassinate Leary?
There seems to have been, I mean, incredibly great divisions of those persons who were using LSD. And the main question, I guess, was what should we be using this drug for? Who should be having it available to them? There were great, great divisions, even within the CIA, as to the purpose of LSD. Hubbard, although he turned on several thousand people, upwards of 6,000 people, according to the research that I did, always kept the dispersion of LSD to those people who he trusted, who would use it in a more or less, and I use great cynical quotations here, responsible way. He would give it to psychiatrists, The psychiatrists would make informed judgments as to the people that they would give it to. Who knows who can be trusted with anything? But Hubbard was not a popularizer of acid. Leary was. He just wanted it on the streets. And Hubbard just hated the idea. And
so Hubbard was sort of an elitist about who should get it. Essentially, you had to have a certain educational or financial background to get his LSD.
I would say that Huxley was the most elitist about the use of LSD. Hubbard came in second. And Leary was just a fanatic for spreading.
Well, sure, and I mean, that was the big divide between them, and, you know, there's even a comment from Jay Stevens in the intro to their book, one of their books, I forget, I have it in my recent article, where, you know, they're talking about using all of this stuff to dumb down the masses and attack the intellect, etc.
Yeah. So, Hubbard didn't agree with the way that Leary was using what was really Hubbard's substance. I mean, he was the chief importer of it to North America, period.
And so, yeah, and he was the number, wasn't he one of the key people fighting the U.S. government to keep LSD legal in 1966?
Yes, according to my conversation.
The number one smuggler of it is the number one person trying to keep it legal. You know, there's no irony at all there, is there?
Not at all, not at all.
And he probably made some money off of it. Go ahead, sorry.
No, not at all. Myron Stolaroff told me in one of maybe three or four phone calls that I had with Myron Stolaroff that in 1966, when California declared LSD to be absolutely illegal, and then in 1968, the federal government declared it as being a Schedule I substance with no medical value, with felony imprisonment minimum being 15 years in prison for simple possession of LSD. Al Hubbard was incensed and went personally to Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who then took the cause into the Senate chambers and did not win. But Hubbard went directly to Hubert Humphrey.
Why don't we get into your documents on Al Hubbard now? And I have them numbered from 2 through 17. I may be missing number 1. The first one I have is a letter from Sandoz Pharmaceuticals to Al Hubbard at Uranium Corp of BC Limited. And it says, "Dear Al Hubbard, this is to acknowledge the receipt of your telegram, and in compliance with your request, we are enclosing the herewith Canadian Customs Form number 267 in triplicate, covering the 43 boxes of LSD 25 ampules, which we have forwarded to you on May 20th via parcel post." Yeah. So, I mean, this is primary documents, folks.
Yeah. And all those documents that you're going to speak of can...
Well, no, you're going to speak of them. I'm just going to mention them.
Well, even the documents you're mentioning came out of the house of one Bill Darling in Thousand Oaks, California.
And again, that one single connection. So, and have you gotten any that you've published from the FOIA requests and this stuff as well?
The stuff that I got from the FOIA request was all of the commonly issued redacted material that came from the Church Commission congressional investigation of the CIA on MKUltra. Anybody who's done any kind of research has the same stuff that I have. It's very, very – the CIA gives out what it wants to give out, and that's what I got. The only other interesting thing was that forward cover letter saying that we have no documents whatsoever on one Alfred M. Hubbard.
Now, let's talk about this document that you've published here, the Cathedral of the Holy Rosary. What was that about?
As I said to you in conversations a couple days ago or yesterday, Hubbard was a fanatical Catholic.
Did he want the Catholic Church handing out LSD, or what was his gig?
Yeah, he wanted everybody. Well, that's an overstatement. Leary wanted everybody, but
he wanted the right people in the right class range to give it out, right? Okay.
Including members of the Catholic Church. And he claims, Al Hubbard claims, and I do have, well, I set my eyes on, I didn't take it out of the house, but Hubbard claimed to have had a private session with the Pope in the Vatican and was discussing the value of LSD with the Pope.
All right. Here's another Sandoz Pharmaceutical letter from August 12, 1959. Do you want to go into that one? What's the significance of this one? It looks like it's quite a lot.
You read it to me. I don't have these things.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. So it's some time ago, Dr. A.M. Hubbard and Dr. Hoffer brought to my attention that you had formed a research group for LSD therapy together with various colleagues at the Hollywood Hospital, New Westminster. I was very much interested to hear of the encouraging therapeutic results you have had with LSD in the treatment of alcoholics. Moreover, our regional minister, Mr. L. Patterson, has also informed me of your important and far-reaching work with alcoholics and requesting that we send you our annotated bibliography on LSD. Unfortunately, at the time, we did not dispose of this material, but our pleased to advise you that it has now become available and will be sent to you under separate cover. You want to go on for that one? Here, let me go into this, because now they're getting specifically into the word teonanacotyl for the word mushroom, and this is from August 12, 1959, from Dr. J. Ross McLean from Vancouver. And so he says in the next paragraph, at the same time, I am also sending you unpublished notes on psilocybin, the active principles of the famed Mexican mushroom teonanacotyl, which, of course, was popularized by Gordon Wasson, who is in charge of MKUltra Subproject 58. More precisely, the species psilocybe mexicana Heim, and of course Roger Heim was on Wasson with those trips, and some literature on Maril and theori design, a derivative which we hope to introduce in Canada in the near future. Yeah, in what way are they introducing these drugs?
Through psychiatric hospitals and Hollywood Hospital.
Well, I mean, you know, just like LSD was eventually made it all over the streets, as did the mushrooms and everything else, you know. And in fact, the original article from May 13, 1957, on the front page of the Life magazine article when they first made it popular is a statement by basically children's allotments or something like that. I'm not remembering exactly, you know, I'd have to pull it up here. But, you know, you can see the comment magic mushrooms up in the top right corner, and it's talking about that. And then the very next line down in the same black box, it talks about teenage allowances.
Interesting. So maybe you have primary proof that there was a plan to actually distribute psychedelics to the masses.
Oh, I think absolutely. That's exactly what we're talking about. You know, and I think that the outline of LSD was essential for that, because, you know, it's just like Holland has proved that the kids don't want to use drugs that are legal, you know, especially kids that are rebellious. And so when you outlaw them, it creates a much, much larger market for the drugs when they're outlawed. So I wonder if Al Hubbard's outpouring against it being outlawed was either a stage, or, you know, it was because he would have lost control probably, you know, through the underground market.
That's what I think. I think the number two supposition is correct.
Right.
Apparently, according to the FOIA requests that Hank Alberelli had done and that Russ Kick had done of the FBI and the investigations that I had done, Al Hubbard had stockpiled via his procurement of acid, LSD from Sandoz Laboratories, more LSD than the entire CIA had stockpiled and more than the Army Chemical Corps had stockpiled.
Now, do you have any idea how he got the exclusive license agreement with Sandoz? What would have come made that happen?
That I do not know, but I have set eyes. I did not take it out of the house. Should have, but I didn't. I've set eyes on the original document that was investigational new drug permit number one, which was granted to Al Hubbard by the Canadian government.
Sure, and I think, is that in here in these documents that you released?
There's a reference to it, but there's not the actual primary document.
Gotcha, okay. So now, let's see here. Here's another one. Thank you very much for sending the book so promptly. I look forward to receiving it. We are sending you two bottles of nicotinic acid by airmail today, and also I am enclosing my treatment plan for schizophrenics. You will find everything as described in this outline. A Hoffer PhD, MD, Director of Psychiatric Research to Al Hubbard. And then let's just go to the next one here. November 28, 1962. This is to Dr. Hubbard from Ruby Rosenberg. Dear Dr. Hubbard, enclosed, please find two copies of the statement of investigator to be completed and returned at your earliest possible convenience. 500 grams of this product. I mean, people, you know, micrograms is what you use to dose people with LSD, micrograms. So they're talking 500 grams of LSD. That's probably enough to dose a city the size of L.A. But, you know,
It's enough to dose 5 million people. 500 grams.
Yeah, that's about the city of L.A., so there you go. So 500 grams of this product should be ready for shipment during the second week of December, at which time we will airmail it to your attention as usual. And then it says Gillard Schlesinger Chemical Manufacturer Corp. and signed Rudy Rosenberg. I mean, this is just really, you know, this is good stuff here for sure. Yeah. And so here's another one, 1966 registration of drug establishment, Alfred M. Hubbard. And then we've got A.M. Hubbard, PhD, Assistant Director, Human Factors Department. That's another interesting one that uses more investigation. And interesting, it's also at Teledyne. And it says, Dear Hubbard, thank you for the material on LSD, which you forwarded to me. I find it most interesting and would like to discuss this quote-unquote problem with you. I wonder what the problem was. I have asked one of my assistants in Los Angeles to contact you shortly. And then next letter here. Dear Dr. Hubbard, and this is again Teledyne Systems, obviously, and this is Hawthorne, California, so obviously there's a tie-in directly at Teledyne to MKUltra with reference to your letter of July 2, 1966. This directorate will take no objection to your taking 1 gram of LSD out of Canada for the purpose of having put into capsules and in, the encapsulated material then to be re-entered into Canada in your possession. So, wow. So he needs to bring it down to the Teledyne Corporation to capsulate the LSD in 1966, the same year the hearings are being held for LSD, and then take it back to Canada. All right. Teledyne. Woohoo. All right. So Hollywood Hospital.
A fun place to work at that time, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. You know, and geez, man. Yeah, you know, except they're using all of this stuff, in my opinion, for this whole archaic revival and neo-feudalism that they're selling. It is my
For the wrong purposes, yes.
Yes, and it is, yeah, to dumb people down, essentially, you know, as they say, and, you know, as Jay Stevens, et cetera, talk about. It is my pleasure to testify that the above-mentioned Dr. A.M. Hubbard has been closely associated with me in the role of consultant and advisor with regard to chemicals used in psychiatric therapy. This is Ross McLean, medical director of Hollywood Hospital, folks, talking about his ties with, oh boy, with MKUltra and drugging his patients, probably unwittingly most of the time. And let's see, it says, it will be appreciated by the writer of this letter because of the above-mentioned relationship and any courtesies which may be extended to Dr. Hubbard. This letter is written particularly in view of the fact that Dr. Hubbard intends traveling within the Soviet Union during the next few weeks. Hello, folks. Oh, and by the way, Wasson and his wife were in and out of Russia, and she was a former Russian intelligentsia, which means Russian elite. And my suspicion, based on all of the evidence and his Toward a Russian Policy book that I've gotten access to, was that Wasson was a Russian spy. And he continues here, I am in the hope that he will find the time to visit with our many scientific friends in that country. Oh, so wait a second. Wait for it, folks. They want Al Hubbard to start LSD MKUltra-like studies in Russia.
Incredible. And most incredible is that hardly anybody knows about this man named Al Hubbard.
Go ahead and talk for a second here.
Yeah, nobody knows about Al Hubbard. He's just a blank page in history books, in sociology, in medical literature. Nobody wants to talk about him. And obviously there are reasons why. The CIA was pushing LSD before it became a dirty little word. The CIA was into it, and Al Hubbard was the chief importer of LSD from Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland. Nobody talks about him. Why is this?
That's incredible stuff, man. And you know, and here he is trying to get this stuff going in the Soviet Union, too. You know, what more do you need, folks? Dear sirs, this will advise that this department will have no objection to your importing and using the drug mescaline and lysergic acid dimethylamide in the research branch of your laboratories. And this is National Health Department of National Health and Welfare of Canada. So, I mean, here is the Canadian government at basically, you know, giving approval for the MK Ultra studies headed by Al Hubbard. And then let's see.
Can I stop you right there?
Go ahead.
John, second?
Yeah.
All right. Everybody, when they think of LSD, thinks of one of two things, the Grateful Dead or Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary.
Who supplied them?
Oh, no, that too. But Timothy Leary received his first trip and his first shipment of LSD from none other than Alfred Matthew Hubbard.
And because Leary wanted to spread it faster than Hubbard, then Leary was the bad guy that Hubbard wanted to murder. I got it.
Hubbard wanted the synthetic magic mushroom, which is psilocybin. And for some reason, either didn't have it or couldn't get it or something. Leary had a contract with Sandoz Laboratories for the synthetic magic mushroom compound, psilocybin, but he didn't have LSD, so they swapped.
Interesting.
Yep.
So I don't know if we want to go into any more of these, or is you think that's good enough? I mean, people have a really good picture; they can read the rest of these. But if you think there's any more specifically that we should talk about, let's do that.
It's your show. I'm not going to advise you.
All right. Well, let's go into one more here from Stanford Research Institute, October 2nd, 1968. Dear Al, our investigations of some of the current social movements affecting education, the ones that they launch, indicate that drug usage prevalent among student members of the new left is not entirely undesigned. Huh, that's what I've been arguing. So some of it appears to be present as a deliberate weapon aimed at political change. Hey, thanks for that. Oh, and by the way, this is from Willis H. Herrmann that you were already talking about, who is a proved and known MK Ultra doctor. We are concerned.
And the head of SRI.
And the head of SRI, right. We are concerned with assessing the significance of this. And of course, they launched this. So they're just like, backpatting, like, hey, you know, do a follow up study on that, you know, little experiment that you launched a few years ago. And we can't let this get by here. This connection, it would be advantageous to you to have you considered in the capacity of special investigative agent who might have access to relevant data, which is not ordinarily available. If this can be arranged, it could be of a great it could be, it could help us a great deal. And so, wow, I mean, it's just, you couldn't get any more obvious. And then this is the Department of the Army to Stanford Research Institute. Gentlemen, I have received certain documents from Special Agent A.M. Hubbard to be Special Agent, folks, Special Agent A.M. Hubbard to be given to Major William E. Smith, etc. So there you have it. Admitted right there that he is a special agent and he is running all of these drugs and doing these studies. All primary documentation.
And Al Hubbard was the primary source of LSD to the CIA and to the Army Chemical Corps, period.
And so, let's see, is there anybody we didn't cover? We got Al Hubbard, Humphrey Osmond. Did we cover Abram Hoffer?
Abram Hoffer was a psychiatrist who was operating in British Columbia along the same lines as was Humphrey Osmond, and then Weyburn Hospital in Saskatchewan, doing the same kind of research on psychedelics, the relationship to schizophrenia and psychosis, and possibly how to cure it. That was the assumption, that LSD could be a cure for psychosis. Abram Hoffer, the only thing interesting that I have to say about him, and I did interview him, when the federal government in 1968 made LSD a Schedule I substance, illegal, with no medical usage, and imprisonment being 15 years felony for simple possession. Al Hubbard begged, literally begged, and I have this on tape from Abram Hoffer, begged him to hide his stash of LSD in Abram Hoffer's clinic, because Abram Hoffer's clinic was in Canada and not in the U.S., and Hoffer refused. He thought it was too risky and he wouldn't do it. And so the explanation that I got from Myron Stolaroff is, instead of sending it back, instead of Al Hubbard sending his stash, his huge stash of LSD back, he buried it somewhere in Death Valley.
So get this. So now that's an interesting tie-in, because then you go into Allen Ginsberg, who does Gregory Bateson, who is at the Macy Foundation conferences that founded MKUltra. Ginsberg murdered his wife. Where again?
No, that was William Burroughs. Please don't mistake.
Oh, William Burroughs murdered his wife at Death Valley. You sure?
Okay.
Well, because William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg were best friends.
They were best friends, and they were lovers, actually.
So you're sure it was William Burroughs that murdered his wife in Death Valley?
Absolutely correct.
Okay, because William Burroughs is the one who first sold the idea of using 2012 for social control. So thanks for catching that error for me, because this is something that I've just been piecing together over the last week here.
Right.
So, Todd, what is the single most important subject that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Do your own research. Nothing's going to be given to you. You're not going to read it in books in school. You're going to have to search for it. There's a great connection between LSD and the CIA. However, and I'm going to go out on a limb because it's my honest belief, I don't think LSD is an evil substance. I think that it has many, many great attributes to it. And I, as have you, Jan, and I'm only saying this because it was on your interview yesterday with Deanna Spingola, I've done acid hundreds and hundreds of times.
Likewise.
I have never, ever, not once, had a flip out. I've never had a bad experience. I've had a few hairy moments. One stupid thing I did was walk into a shopping mall with a head full of LSD, which was a dumb thing to do. But that's it. I've never had a bad experience using LSD. I don't want people to think this is a terrible substance. You're going to kill someone or commit suicide if you do LSD. You might, but you're not going to necessarily.
I think the issue behind these things is how, you know, subversive thoughts can be sold along with them, like the Agenda 21 and New Age type stuff, as we've exposed, and getting people to essentially stop thinking critically and stop investigating and just accepting these New Age cults at face value. And I think that's the real danger with a systematic method of critical thinking and verifying the information.
I'd agree with you. I think critical thinking and logic is super important, and it is not taught enough in universities, and people need to be able to critically think according to Aristotle's codified logic and other forms of logic. I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. Well, you know, and we were just up to the last question here. Would you like to provide the titles of any books, websites, et cetera, that you want people to know about?
Yeah. I mean, one is simply out of the need to air what I've done for the last, I believe it's 25 years. And so I would like listeners to visit www.fargonebooks.com and see what I've done in terms of research on the LSD's the CIA's LSD experiments. So go to fargonebooks.com, and the other URLs that I have are far too lengthy to get into in terms of...
And we will be including everything up there, and I'm going to be, rather than sending everybody to the Wayback Machine, I'll be posting the documents that we read through on the Gnostic Media website to this episode so that people can download them directly.
Well, thank you very much, Jan, for everything you've done.
And thank you so much, Todd, for the wonderful interview and very eye-opening material. And thank you so much for doing the research that you've done.
You're welcome, and vice versa. Talk to you soon.
Likewise.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.